Hi everyone, Carl here. Just wanted to say a couple of things before we get started today. Firstly, I think the podcast will now be coming to you roughly every 2 weeks for the remainder of the year, because I'm currently really busy with a range of other commitments. Secondly, as you'll hear, today's episode was an in-person recording, not done over Skype as I normally do. So you may notice that the acoustics in the room we had weren't perfect, and we also had a very creaky table and chairs to contend with. So I hope these issues don't affect your enjoyment too much. Okay, let's get on with the show. Welcome back, everybody, to the Movie Palace. I'm your host, as ever, Carl Sweeney, and thank you for joining me this week for our episode all about The Innocents, the 1961 British horror film directed by Jack Clayton, starring Deborah Carr. The screenplay of this film is credited to William Archibald and Truman Capote, and I am delighted to be joined by two guests for this week's episode, two podcast debutantes, I think. Thomas Wilson and Charlotte Goff. Hi, guys.
Hi, how are you?
Yeah, really good, thanks. And I should say, listeners, if this episode sounds a little different to what we normally do, that's because we're coming to you this week from the library of the University of Wolverhampton. Not quite gothic surroundings, but, you know, we've booked out a guest room today. So, I think we should introduce the pair of you first. So, well, you're both PhD researchers, aren't you? So, Thomas, tell us a bit about you and what you kind of look into and stuff like that.
So, yeah, I'm doing PhD research at the University of Wolverhampton.
Yeah.
It's in relation to horror television, which is specifically anthology format television. So, I'm looking at horror anthology series that have got hosts. So, you know, we're talking Alfred Hitchcock Presents and that type of horror anthology series. And sort of doing a historical and industry account of the, you know, history of that type of programming.
So yeah, Hitchcock, people like Rod Serling as well, he'd be in that kind of category?
So he hosted The Twilight Zone from 1959 to mid-60s, and then he did another horror anthology called Rod Serling's The Night Gallery, which was about a decade later. And yeah, in a similar sort of role as a host of horror specialised TV.
Do we still get programmes like this anymore? It's my feeling like they kind of changed or disappeared. What's the modern equivalent?
So, well, they've always remained, I guess, you know, constant throughout TV history. We've had periods where there was more of them, such as the 50s and 60s. And then sort of followed with a decline in the following decades, the 70s and 80s. There still was, obviously, that type of programming, but other formats became more popular.
Yeah.
And specifically in relation to horror and gothic, we had move away from anthology format in the sort of mid-60s towards serialized programming, you know, hybrids like comedy, horror sort of things. And it's returned in recent decades. You had things like Tales from the Crypt in the 90s, which is popular. And then, it's been more sporadic. You'd have, recent years, we've got, obviously, the most popular is probably Black Mirror.
Yeah. Without the host, I guess.
Yeah, it's more the base around the writer, producer, with Charlie Brooke. Yeah.
It's fascinating stuff, yeah. Charlotte, how about you? So your research is in a different area, though, isn't it? Mm-hmm. But still pretty spooky stuff.
Yeah, so I do my PhD at Manchester Metropolitan University, and I'm looking at American film from the 80s and 90s within the Satanic Panic era, looking at the representation and relationship between masculinity and trauma in these films and connected to Satanic Panic.
So what is Satanic Panic exactly? Like, you mean like a moral panic? Or?
Yeah, so it was a cultural hysteria like that went on a national scale around satanic cults and ritual abuse, and attributing kind of non-traditional religions to Satanism and people having supposedly repressed memories of satanic abuse from childhood and things like that, and it kind of, the hysteria around Satanism and the occult extended to, you know, heavy metal music, board games, that kind of thing.
So what are like some of the go-to films in that kind of mode? I think Angel Heart's the one that popped into my head. Is that the kind of thing?
Yeah, that's definitely the one that kind of set me off on this. Cool. That's one of my favourites. And things like The Believers, same year, with Martin Sheen. Even Devil's Advocate, a bit later on.
Yeah.
Fallen, with Denzel Washington.
Nice. Well, this film is not quite in that mode, is it? I mean, it's got stuff about good and evil in there and, you know, all this kind of stuff. But we'll get into it. So, The Innocents is about a governess, played by Carr, who is tasked with looking after two children at a country estate. However, she soon discovers that the assignment is not necessarily a straightforward one. And what I would say, I don't know if you two would agree, but anyone listening who hasn't seen this film, I think do yourselves a favour. Run to find a copy. Check it out if you possibly can. Do you think that's fair to say?
Definitely. It's my favourite film of all time.
Well, let's start with that then. So, yeah, personal history with the film. So why is it your favourite? What's so good about this film then?
Yeah, well, I was first introduced to it. I was third year of undergrad, my university, and in the Gothic literature module, looking at ghost stories and Turn of the Screw, which of course this is adapted from. We showed a little clip from it and I was just like astounded by this film. I can't believe I've never come across it before. And then I watched it soon after at like 2 a.m. and just thought, wow, there is nothing like this. And it holds up so well. It's probably one of the most unsettling things. Even, you know, for like modern audiences, I don't think there's anything that really compares to how it represents. It's supernatural.
Yeah, it's very distinctive, I think. And I'd only seen this film once before this week, and it'd been a while, and it was fun because like a lot of the details just kind of blurred in my mind and couldn't quite remember everything about it. The moment I remembered most distinctly from the first time I saw it, actually, is that moment, I think it's like the hide-and-seek sequence, isn't it? You know where Quint appears at the window when she stood behind the curtain? I just remember that terrifying me the first time I'd seen this film.
That was the clip that I first saw that prompted me to watch it, yeah.
And like this time I remembered that was coming, so it didn't have quite the same effect, but there were other things in the film I'd forgotten about. But yeah, Thomas, what about you? I mean, do you hold this film in the same kind of high esteem or not?
I've really, really appreciate this film. I've not seen it quite as many times as Charlotte has. I've seen it 3 times. I watched it a couple of years ago, then again last year, and then again last week. And like you, there was moments from it that I'd forgotten about it, but I think that worked really well with the sort of ambiguity of the film in general, that I'd forgotten a lot and was able to when I rewatched it, I was able to look at things in a different way, maybe. So, yeah, it's one of those films you can just keep coming back to, I guess.
See new things.
Very high, like, replay value, I think.
Yeah, definitely, yeah.
Yeah, because of, like you say, ambiguity. And it's interesting what you say about it being different to kind of other horror films, isn't it? Because, yeah, why is that? It's kind of restrained, isn't it? Mm. And that's not how horror films are typically done now. But it also kind of contrasts with some of the stuff at the time, the kind of Hammer horror stuff, doesn't it? But it really works. It, like, really gives things, like, an insidious kind of it kind of sneaks up on you, doesn't it?
Definitely.
Yeah, well, that was sort of one of the things about this film in terms of its historical context. It is, some critics were looking at it as like this suggestive ghost story, obviously that what it's adapted from. But then other critics were talking about the more sort of, more in accordance with Hammer style at the time, which was more overt, I guess. And I guess it was sort of
grand period kind of billowing curtains.
Oh, yeah. So, like, if you watch the trailer that was originally used for the film, they market it as almost like a Hammer film.
Yeah, it's quite a notorious trailer.
Yeah, like B-movie style. Yeah.
I didn't see the trailer, so what's...
It's quite notorious for completely misrepresenting
the
film. But yeah, it makes it look very much like B-movie, like schlock kind of thing. And there's a phrase that gets repeated about three times, like, do they return to possess the living, or something like that. And they say about three times. And
yeah, there's like a voiceover, the classic horror voiceover for the trailer.
Oh, yeah.
That sort of low, deep voice, male voice, isn't it? And it's almost marketed like this chiller film that's going to be really scary.
And it focuses on that one particular scene where Deborah Carr's walking through the corridors with the candelabra.
Yeah.
And there's all that wailing going on, which, is very sort of a subjective scene in that,
In the actual context of the film.
Yeah, but in this sense, it was just like this onslaught of spirits.
I suppose you can understand that, can't you? Because it is a time when the Hammer films were, like, so popular. But then, like you said, there's this disconnect between the publicity material and the film itself. Mm. So, yeah, that's the kind of thing I've picked up, is, like, from reading around the film, it's like it wasn't gory enough for a lot of people who were drawn to Hammer, but then it was too Hammer for some fans of Henry James.
Yeah.
So this weird thing where the film kind of has gained an appreciation over time that wasn't necessarily there from everybody in 1961. It's kind of fascinating, isn't it? Like, the perception has changed drastically over the last couple of decades, it seems like.
And of course it came a year after Psycho as well, which kind of changed the face of horror.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think on some of the posters of The Innocents, it's kind of made to look a bit like Psycho.
Yeah, like a suspense thriller. Yeah. It's marketed that same poster.
Yeah.
Thunder style based.
Yeah, like Janet Leigh and Deborah Carr kind of framed in a similar way.
That's really interesting, yeah.
Yeah, but, like what you're saying, like maybe, over time it's become seen as like a, a classic, obviously gothic film. At the time, obviously, it being in that middle ground between not being gory enough for some of the Hammer fans and then, being too gory for the, original fans of this story. But also it's sort of that style at the time, well, especially maybe in the decades before with things like The Old Dog House and the Haunted House film was very much, well, it would have more comedy aspects in it.
Because there's not really any levity as such in this film, is there? Forgotten it.
Yeah, maybe some audiences at the time were probably used to that, maybe Haunted House is having that more comedy aspect to it, which this just doesn't have, does it? I mean,
no, it's pretty relentless, isn't it? What's going on in this film then? Because I think that's one of the interesting things, is that it kind of encourages, or it can allow for different takes on what's actually going on, isn't it? So it's like, is it all in the mind of this character? Are the ghosts actually real? Or is it something kind of in between, where she's kind of a conduit and she's summoning all this stuff and drawing all the evil out? So yeah, I don't know. There's a line that struck me as interesting where she says, sometimes one can't help imagining things. But how do you kind of take it? Do you think that it's all in her mind or not?
I think it's definitely in the middle. And I think it's made in that way. I think I've read and heard that Jack Clayton very much wanted to, have everyone make up their own mind, essentially.
Yeah.
I think the opening, obviously we've got that very eerie, like, opening with the song and everything, but I think the first scene with the children's uncle, really sets that up, her, like, state of mind and, the fact that, it's her, like, first job, first time away from home. She's a parson's daughter. She's very, like, sheltered and impressionable. And the exchange that she has with this uncle, she's just very naive, kind of girlish, prone to, he says to her, do you have an imagination? Yeah. And so it's like planting those seeds of, like, this could all be in her mind. Yeah, I think we'll talk more about how the shots are set up and everything.
Because this is something that I didn't necessarily notice initially, but then on rewatching the film and just looking at some of the extras on the BFI release and stuff about how we typically see Miss Giddens reaction prior to seeing what she sees, with some exceptions though.
Yeah.
But how do you see that, Thomas? It kind of strengthens the idea that what we're seeing might be kind of, like mediated through her perspective or something.
Yeah, it definitely seems more so that way for the first half of the film, doesn't it? I mean, the reaction shots from her, especially when in relation to when there's appearances of ghosts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you always get her reaction before you see a ghost, so you're very much with her point of view, aren't you? But as it goes on, it changes some of the dynamics in that sense a bit later on, where sometimes there'll be a shot that includes her and the ghost in the same shot.
Yeah.
So it starts to adjust, and I guess that's Jack Clayton sort of playing with the audience a bit.
Yeah.
In terms of the ambiguity, is it suggesting that it's in her mind, or is it, you know, we don't know.
They almost seem to converge a bit, don't they? Giddens and, what's her name, Miss Jessel.
Miss Jessel, yeah. And you do that with costume really well. Like.
Yeah, with the black costume.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She goes like, so it goes from kind of like...
It Deborah kind of darkens, Carr, doesn't it?
Over. Yeah, Deborah Carr being that famous for The King and I, and you've got like these kind of huge skirts and, you know, kind of like a bonnet and things, and then, you know, goes into this like black dress, you know, reminiscent of Miss Jessel. And this is one in one particular shot when she's seen Miss Jessel across the lake in the reeds. She's trying to get, I think this is a scene where she's trying to get...
That's a terrifying scene, by the way.
Oh, yeah, that's like... yeah, she's trying to get Flora to, like, look at her, saying she's there, she's there. And then Flora kind of goes off, like, screaming, and we get this shot of Miss Giddens and her reflection on the surface of the water. And it's like how she could, you know, in her state of mind, because she could very easily have been looking at that and not, you know, this ghost. But, yeah...
Yeah, and I think that's, in terms of, obviously we've got the sort of cinematography, reaction shots and the type of shots we're seeing, and in relation to Miss Giddens and the evolution of that character in the film. But then it's also working on different levels, isn't it? In terms of like the setting, for instance, when she first arrives there, it's very, to her, it's a very pleasant place, it's very bright, very nice setting. And then as... You know, the innocence is lost from what's going on around her, so is the setting. It's becoming a lot darker, isn't it?
Yeah.
Rainy and gloomy.
Yeah, and you get, like, just this... The garden is just beautiful, but it's decaying. And all the petals are falling off everything, and there's reptiles everywhere, and...
It's true, though, isn't it? It's like you say, when she first arrives, and there's this, like, huge lake and this winding pathway and stuff... It's like it's got this fairy tale feel, hasn't it, Bly?
Yeah.
And that kind of gets negated as the film goes on, like the weather gets worse.
Mm.
I mean, let's talk about that. I mean, that would be one aspect of the film that really aligns with, like, the gothic nature of it. And, you know, you read stuff about The Innocents and it'll say, like, this quintessential gothic tale and so on. I mean, is that how you guys see it? Would you say it's, like, exactly emblematic of, like, the gothic film? Mm. Is it a quintessential gothic piece?
Well, I think what makes The Innocents so interesting is the fact that so much of it takes place outside in the bright sunlight, which to me is more eerie than anything that's quintessentially gothic, like the old dark house and the stormy night kind of thing.
Yeah.
And, yeah, especially in the black and white framing, there's just something so unsettling about that setting. And, you know, that probably my favourite scene in the film is when... She sees, like, kind of the silhouette on the tower that she thinks is Peter Quinn. And when she looks up, the birds song, like, mutes. And obviously she's kind of blinded by the sunlight. And it's almost like kind of, you know, the veil between the living and the dead is kind of, like, broken down at this, like, one moment. And then it kind of gets, it comes back again. She hears the birds song and, like, her vision kind of readjusts. And it's just... so interesting. And there's a scene that's so similar to that in Carnival of Souls, which came out like a year later, where, you know, she's kind of in between the living and the dead also. And again, she's like, just the city world around her is just muted. And no one kind of will acknowledge her existence, like she's kind of become a ghost.
Mm.
And I just find that fascinating.
So I suppose this film, if you were doing like a gothic checklist or something, Thomas, you'd have like supernatural elements, you've got this old estate, this vast house kind of thing.
also like ambiguities between good and evil, but just like this overall feeling of like gloom and dread and yeah. So as an example of the Gothic, how squarely do you think it fits in that tradition?
You've got things like ambiguity surrounding what's happened in the past at this particular setting,
mm-hmm.
in relation to two ghosts, and there's, you know, this suggestion that they had something sinister going on with, in relation to the children, isn't there? Which has then had an effect on the children. So there's this thing of now these two characters returning as ghosts.
Mm.
So obviously we've got this return. And it's got other things going on, you know, going beyond that in terms of stuff in relation to Freudian stuff as well, which is obviously can be related to the Gothic, I guess, can't it?
And you've got a lot of doubling going on, as I mentioned before. And
so like doubling of characters.
Yeah, so like Flora and Miss Jessel,
yeah.
Quint and Miles, Miss Jessel and Miss Giddens. A lot, so that doubling, especially with the children, it's kind of to question their innocence, you know. How much are they complicit with these ghosts? How are they communicating with them somehow? How much kind of have they been corrupted by them and have all this kind of adult knowledge? And there are so many scenes where Flora seems to be kind of looking off into the distance of something. Yeah, or like Miles won't answer something that Miss Giddens asks him, as if they're like, and they're whispering all the time.
Yeah.
I think that's what Miss Giddens says. They're whispering all the time. Oh, there's this one line where Miss Giddens says to Mrs. Gross, she said about Flora, she said she's not a child, she's an old woman. So it's, yeah, this kind of uncanny adult child, I think, that really makes it so creepy. Miles, just as this like adult in a 10-year-old's body.
It's really unsettling, isn't it? And I suppose it's doubling, and there's also kind of contrast, isn't there? Because you have like the contrast between like repression and sexual fascination and good and evil and life and death. Who do you think the title refers to? Because it's not necessarily a straightforward answer, is it? Because the innocence, maybe face value, you'd think it's the children, but I don't know. Maybe it's not.
Yeah, so I guess when Jack Clayton set out to make this film, obviously with help from Truman Capote as well, who did 90% of the screenplay in the end, they were very focused on it being drama that was just focused on the four main players in the cast. So we've got Miss Giddens, Miss Gross, and then the two children. So it's, it's very much focused on them, and I think you can look at all four in terms of this, in terms of innocence. Even like at Miss Gross at first, you don't really know a lot about Miss Gross at first here, but then you start to realise, is she hiding stuff?
Yeah.
Is there stuff she knows that she's not letting on?
And there's little bits of detail that come out like as time goes on.
And she gets a bit more assertive towards Giddens, doesn't she, as well?
Yeah, and I think it's interesting what you're saying in relation to the children. And then Miss Giddens, if you're, for parts of the film, if your perspective is, as a viewer, aligned with her, even the things that they do that in normal circumstances with, normal everyday children would do certain activities and behave in a certain way, wouldn't they? But then in the context of what's going on, it starts to become sinister, even though it's most of the time it's just innocent stuff. But
so obviously with all like the past trauma that the children have suffered with these companions, Miss Jessel and Peter Quinn, kind of dying quite kind of deeply horrifying ways, and like the children have found them or like are just privy to all of this detail. And Mrs. Gross, I think, is very much trying to kind of keep everything, repressed and not spoken about. And whereas Miss Giddens, in a sort of hysteria, is the one that kind of wants the children to confront everything and confront all of their like knowledge and like especially like to name the Miss Jessel and Peter Quinn. Like naming their like trauma and things, and like so this like adult knowledge that she's kind of like putting onto them is kind of the thing that she's afraid of them knowing. Like, she's afraid of them knowing too much, but she's actually kind of putting that on them and kind of traumatizing them. So it's like what she's trying to protect them from. Because she says at the beginning, you know, all I want to do is to save the children, not destroy them. Whereas she's kind of doing that to them. So, yeah.
Do you think there's a kind of mismatch between the fact that Carla is 40, I think, and the character is supposed to be this governess who's taking her first job
and
like
things. 20, yeah.
Yeah. So, but does that harm the film, or does it kind of serve it in a funny sort of way?
Well, I think kind of the idea that she's kind of this very, like, sexually repressed kind of character, I think that lends really well to it. And also Deborah Carr as, you know, her star persona, like, I think known most for The King and I, where she played a governess there. So I think she carries that over in this and kind of is kind of like a subversion of that character in that film.
It's interesting because I think when you think of like actresses of the 50s into the 60s, I'm not sure she'd be the first name that came up, you know, came to people's minds, but she's in stuff like The King and I think Black Narcissus from Power Pressburg, that's a little early, I think that's the late 40s, isn't it? But she just had a From Here to Eternity and things like that. She had a great career. It's fascinating because she really bears the brunt of the story, doesn't she? Like, she's on screen in like every scene, I think. But how do you feel about her kind of performance anyway?
Yeah, so the sort of thing that Deborah Kerr has got going on in quite a few films is this, I think she even refers to it in an interview, is that she's not this sort of, got this eccentric persona or anything like that. You know, she's quite, she can be quite reserved, I guess, or quite conventional, which I think actually really suits this film.
I was just wondering about your kind of, this might be a bit of a tangent, but I know in your Twitter bio, Charlotte, it's like goth by name, so G-O-U-G-H, goth by nature.
Yeah.
So what is it about, like, the gothic that kind of really appeals to you? Has that always been the case? You've been drawn to these
definitely,
kinds of stories?
Definitely, yeah. I don't know, it's just something that's kind of real but not quite real, very based in trauma and, yeah, like, there's kind of this decadence about it and, yeah.
Do you ever come across people who, like, just don't get it, you know?
Yeah.
Don't really share the same kind of interest.
Yeah, definitely. Or, like, they will relate too much to horror, and whereas it's very much its own thing.
Yeah.
That's where, you talk about, especially if you appreciate the suggestive.
Yes.
Side
and the psychological.
Horror, more towards gothic.
Yeah.
And I think if you do appreciate that, I mean, you know, you can take as much enjoyment from something that's very overt with its horror imagery, and then still, you know, the films that are in between the two, such after which I think the reason I do like The Innocents is because it does fit between the two. It has got some, you know, overt horror imagery in it, especially with, you know, Peter Quint's character, with him coming to the window and stuff, and I think a lot of critics did pick up on that, saying, oh, it's too obvious, or it's... But I think, you know, they do strike a good balance between the two different forms, don't they? More towards the, you know, suggestive gothic and the over Hammer style at the time, I guess.
And I think what's so just interesting and unique about how this film represents its ghosts, as much as it kind of is like a less is more type of thing, it when it does represent them, it's like unflinchingly, it's like to the point where you like have to look away. It's like from, especially from, you know, Miss Jessel in The Reeds.
Yeah.
It's just, it's so prolonged and just terrifying.
Yeah, and the way it slowly unravels, showing their ghosts. I mean, the first time you sort of get a bit of a vague image of Peter Quain on top of that building, don't you? But, you know, at that point, you haven't seen his photo or anything like that. You don't know what he actually looked like. It's just, it's more of a figure on top of a building. And then I think when the scene where it really got to me was that, I think it's about a third of the way through, and she's walking through a corridor and you just see what could almost look like one of the staff at the house.
Yeah.
Because she calls out, like, Anna, doesn't she?
Yeah, she was when she played hide and seek.
You never see, do you?
Yeah.
But it almost could be one of the servants.
Yeah.
And that's what's so sinister about it, is that she doesn't even know that
it's, you know, you just see her quickly walk past at the end of the corridor when she's playing hide and seek. It's just, you weren't ready for that. You know, you're probably thinking more in terms of, you know, there's going to be something related to the children with hide and seek, and it does almost the opposite.
Yeah, and like we've talked a bit about the way the film kind of aligns these characters a bit more closely as the film goes on. So Gidden starts to wear black clothing. They're shown in the same shot at various times, whereas before they hadn't been. And there's that scene where you see Miss Jessel at the desk, isn't there? There's an interesting debate there, because you see a teardrop on the desk, and arguably that makes her more of a tangible presence than the other things do, which you can kind of explain away as she's a manifestation of what's happening in Gidden's mind. And apparently Truman Capote subsequently regretted that inclusion.
I heard that too, yeah.
But was he right to regret it? Did he make a mistake, including that detail?
I didn't really think of it like that at the time when I watched it. I didn't think, aha.
A clue.
Yeah. I think there's also one... I remember there's one scene when, at the end, when, you know, they're in that circle of statues, and you get a shot from... Well, she thinks she sees Peter Quint
as
one of the statues. And I think there is a shot from his, kind of behind him, from that perspective. So it's almost like that could be seen as a shot in itself that also does the same thing, where kind of...
Yeah, and coming back to that in relation to the tear that's on the on the desk, I think I've sort of, you know, citing what Professor Christopher Fralin said here, but he was saying that Truman Capote was being quite harsh on himself there, and that actually, when you think about it, it's still a bit of, you know, the tear will still disappear. It's it's not hard evidence, is it, to say there's a ghost there?
And
it's, if she goes and tells someone that there's a tear there, she still looks.
And it could have been hers.
Yeah, and I guess that's what's a good thing about the supernatural. Mm-hmm. There is unexplained things that happen, and just coinciding with something else that she sees, it could have been anything, couldn't it? So I think that just really plays into the ambiguity, doesn't it?
And that ambiguity, though, is kind of augmented by the style of the film visually, because, well, it's black and white, but this CinemaScope filming process, and I don't know, it's like a film where you have to kind of scour the frame for things at certain times, don't you? And things are hidden, and there's lots of shadow, but then there's also like lots of bright light directed into the frame and stuff. And yeah, what do you make of that? Because it's interesting that CinemaScope, I guess, would be associated, I guess, with more epic storytelling, but this is actually, in a lot of ways, very interior, isn't it? It does have the exterior settings, like you say, but you spend a lot of time with quite a limited cast of characters in the house. And yeah, from what I've read, you know, Freddie Francis found it quite a difficult film to shoot because they're using lots of bright lights and things. Mm-hmm. But whatever the case may be, the end result's wonderful, isn't it?
Yeah, so I think that the reason, you know, with them using the monochrome CinemaScope, it meant that they had to represent the ghost story in a way that probably hadn't been represented that much before. You know, you got, you know, sort of that, what Christopher Fralin was saying is the sort of corner of the retina type of horror, where, you know, the audience is constantly looking at stuff that's on the edge of the frame, you know, even though it's quite blurred because the light's centered down the middle. Yeah, and I think that makes it really interesting that they, you know, because they were in this, you know, context of having to use CinemaScope, you know, they had quite a flattened image, didn't they? And there's, you know, the depth of field is then different. So I think that, yeah.
Yeah, because there's lots of deep focus photography, characters standing behind other characters and things. The moment I was thinking about when I was thinking about scouring the frame, there's a moment in there, Thomas, where you just see some movement. She's looking down a corridor or something, and apparently it's like a clapperboard or something that's been like left in the shot or something, but they decided to put it in the film. And I don't know, I didn't even notice that until I listened to the commentary.
Yeah, and I think there was a few things about the film where you probably, on the first viewing, you might not even notice. And I think, you know, once you've watched it a few times, you start to really appreciate, you know, the amount of, you know, thought that went into certain scenes and certain, you know, certain shots.
In some ways, it's got kind of like a languid feel, hasn't it? And I don't mean that as a criticism, but it's a 99-minute film, and it uses a lot of dissolves, and I don't know, it just seems to kind of draw you into this world, doesn't it? But the transition's really interesting.
It's quite dreamlike all the way through. And yeah, which kind of ties into the dream sequence that happens, like where everything's just kind of in this, like reality is indiscernible from a nightmare. I love how kind of in the background of these shots inside, you've got either like portraits or like a tapestry, or like there's a lot of statues that you can see like from, you know, outside in the window. So just everything's like you have to look for figures, and like you know, you're always looking elsewhere at things you can see.
Yeah, everything's got the potential in every shot to have something sinister attached to it.
Yeah, well, mentioning statues, I think one of my favourite moments is it's like a little cherub statue or something, where the, is it like a beetle or something that crawls from the mouth? Yeah. But it just goes back to that theme of like corrupted innocence that seems to run all through the film, doesn't it? Yeah. I mean, I haven't read The Turn of the Screw, but the consensus seems to be that this is the best, probably, Henry James adaptation, or right up there, you know. Kind of clarify some of the original's ambiguities and obscurities, but without damaging the story's subtlety, is what Peter Bradshaw said in The Guardian. I think, you know, that sounds like a fair assessment to me. I think we've already kind of talked about the ambiguity, but removing that would have been to the detriment of the story, I think, wouldn't it?
Yeah, and I think Jack Clayton, the director, had, when he was, you know, I think he'd finished Room at the Top and he really wanted to adapt Turn of the Screw. And then there'd been the play that had been called The Innocents.
By William Archibald.
So William Archibald wrote that play, and that was sort of, you know, it had the same idea of having just the main four players in the cast, wasn't it? The same four, I think. But it's just all set in this one drawing room. I think it all plays out in this drawing room. And he was saying that, but it's, I think they had the impression that the play sort of went too much the other way, with terms of it making its horror very obvious, and the children were very represented in a very sort of sinister way, and you know, it was very clear to the, you know, theatre goers at the time that it was clear that the children, you know, weren't innocent. Whereas, so I think he was sort of,
and the ghosts were real.
And the ghosts were real, and they made that quite clear, didn't they, in the play? So I think they took certain ideas from that play, you know, the title, but I think they were always going to try and keep it more in line with the original story, because I think Jack Clayton had said, I think he read it when he was about 12 years old or something, and he really responded to it when he was young, although he maybe didn't understand all the themes in the original story. And so, you know, that obviously had a place in his heart much more than, you know, other, I think it was a TV adaptation of it in 1959 maybe, so I don't even know if they watched that or not.
Yeah, and what do you guys make of like the ending of the film? Because from what I've heard, there was some disquiet from like the studio and things, but it's just kind of striking that a film with the 20th Century Fox kind of, you know, released under their banner has this strange ending, you know, with car kissing a dead child on the lips. And I think maybe the idea was like, is this a tasteful thing to put out? Or I don't know. I think it went through some slight revisions, but it's still pretty striking stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, you don't know whether Miles has whipped himself into this frenzy to where he's just kind of died of shock or something, and then, or whether Quint sort of had a supernatural intervention, or whether, you know, Miss Giddens has embraced him to death.
Yeah. Well, I think the way I took it is like, doesn't it sort of build, they're almost like earthbound personifications of good and evil, I think. And I don't know, it's interesting, you have a scene of a church where she's having some really dark thoughts, and she starts using biblical language and things, just the use of black and white, and I don't know, it builds up to this weird two-hander. But yeah, what do you make about the ending, Thomas? Do you think it works?
Yeah, and I quite like that towards the end it's, we've got Miss Giddens and Miles, it's really focused on the two of them, isn't it? At this point, Flora's had to leave, hasn't she, and Miss Giddens almost gone back to, reverted back to what she was like when she first met Flora. You know, she really, you know, when she says to Miss Grace, "Oh, give him my love" or whatever, even though, you know, halfway through the film, she's lost her patience with her and she can't even be in the same room with her. So yeah, well, how it plays out with Miles and Miss Giddens at the end, in that, you know, in that particular place they are in, what is it, that circle where?
Oh yeah, the statue circle thing.
Yeah, I think that's really effective. Mm. And then obviously you've seen Peter Quinn, and you know, the ambiguity even surrounding, you know, that shot you've mentioned earlier about it being from the shot behind the ghost. You know, it's no longer her
subject.
It's not her reaction shot.
It's interesting just from like, on like a production level, because what I've heard is that Clayton was kind of begged by the head of the studio to change the film after the early screenings, but he wouldn't do it. And it's an interesting film because, you know, it's at a time when the studios were distributing films made by independent companies now, and it allowed the studios to kind of cut costs in some ways. So they'd have control over some areas, but not in others. So they apparently insisted that Deborah Carr would be the star of the film. And Jack Clayton was only offered the gig if he'd accept that, is what I've read. I don't know if that's what you guys have heard. But then he obviously had some freedom in other ways, with like being able to resist them, making him change the ending and stuff. But let's be thankful that he got his way, I suppose. Like we said, it had this weird reception. It kind of came and went, didn't it? But do you guys know the fun story involving Francois Truffaut and Clayton? Have you heard that?
Oh, yes. So I think they both went to dinner at some restaurant. I can't remember what it was called. But he got a note, Jack Clayton got a note passed to him from Truffaut saying, "The Innocents is the best British film since Hitchcock left for America."
Mm. And the funny thing about that is Truffaut had once said, "There's something slightly incompatible about placing the words British and cinema together." So it's kind of doubly funny. But yeah, guys, anything else you wanted to point out or discuss about this film before we wrap up? I mean, I suppose the thing to stress is just people should go and see it, you know, if they haven't seen it. But yeah.
I think I watched The Others for the first time recently. And I was very happy to see a few shots that were directly taken from The Innocents. The one that's probably the most fresh in my mind is when someone looks out the window and sees a child outside looking up, which is basically the same shot where Miles is sort of seen in that sort of circle of statues area, looking up at Flora. And obviously The Others thematically is so like The Innocents, in that you've got this hysterical female who's very, you know, devout Christian, who is kind of confides in the servants about her worries. You've got her two children who have seemed to be in league with some ghosts, and again, there are only sort of mild disturbances that happen, but they kind of build up to a frenzy and like a famous twist. It's very, very much kind of in the spirit of the Innocents.
Mm. I really like The Others, actually. Yeah. It's been a while since I've seen it, but I think that's really good. Mm. Yeah. How about you, Thomas?
Yeah, so I think personally for me, yeah, I was going to suggest someone to watch this film for certain reasons. I think two main reasons could be that, you know, in relation to maybe Jack Clayton's a filmmaker, it's quite interesting to look at this in terms of his career as a director. He wasn't that prolific, but he did do some very good quality films. You know, he was sort of part of that at the time, part of that new wave thing going on in Britain, and to go off and do this film when he probably was expected to do something that was probably in more social realism.
You mean like kitchen sink type stuff?
Yeah. And I think it's just really interesting that he decided to do this at this point in his career and was so, you know, dedicated to doing a really gothic adaptation of Turn of the Screw. I find it interesting in terms of that, you know. So, he blends this sort of strong, intimate drama with, you know, really effective moments of supernatural. Yeah, and I guess also his historical context I find, you know, quite interesting. And, you know, you've mentioned it already about how it is now considered, you know, a classic gothic film. But, you know, at the time it did sort of fall into this middle ground of not being what audience audiences were perhaps used to at that time in terms of horror and the gothic. So, yeah.
I'll tell you one thing I wanted to mention actually quickly is Michael Redgrave's really good, isn't he, in the one scene he gets. I think the first time I saw this film, I was kind of waiting for him to come back because you just assume, oh, well, we'll see him later. Mm-hmm. You know, but he makes a real impression, doesn't he, in that mm-hmm. limited screen time through his kind of, I guess, talent, charisma.
Mm-hmm.
And you sort of get why she would be kind of interested in him as well, don't you?
He seems to really charm her in a very short space of time, to do the, you know, this role that she's got to do. It's almost like a love scene, the beginning, for this like naive young woman. It's really good.
Yeah, and I found that quite interesting in terms of Clayton, because, you know, he probably was under pressure to include Michael Redgrave in more scenes than just the one.
Mm.
But he purposely, you know, didn't want to have him in it any more than just that initial scene. He didn't want him to come back in at the end and, you know, wrap up things as such.
Oh, they cut out a scene, didn't they?
Okay.
Where he was supposed to come back, and Miss Giddens was like writing to him, telling him about what's going on, and he wouldn't acknowledge it, type of thing. I think they ended up cutting that scene out because they wanted to retain the kind of world of Bly and keep it very sort of claustrophobic.
Well, I think another story that I think is on the commentary by Christopher Frayling is that Cary Grant was kind of discussed for the role, and apparently it got, you know, they talked to him and he said, yeah, I'll do it if I can turn up at the end and kind of save the day. You know, so obviously that would have been the right way to go, but it's kind of tantalising to think about this film with Cary Grant in it. That's an interesting point to stress, actually. That BFI release is really good of the film, isn't it? And if people really do want to know the minutiae, the commentary is great. That documentary on there is really good too, so people should follow up on that.
Yeah, it's also got Jack Clayton's earlier short film, The Bespoke Overcoat, which is really interesting, actually. If you've watched The Innocents before, you go and watch that short film, because even there it's got signs of, you know, it's got supernatural aspects in that short film, but it's also this really intimate study on just two characters, basically. You know, there is characters beyond that, but it is just focused on two characters, and it's got elements of comedy in there as well, but it's more about the drama and in relation to the supernatural, which then he picks up again with The Innocents.
All right, both. Well, thanks very much for joining me today. It's been a blast. I guess what people might be wondering is, where are you both online? Are you active on social media? Can people find you? Are you on Twitter?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter as well, yeah.
Do you remember your handles?
Or no?
So mine's shargoff7.
Okay, cool.
Mine is thomas_1990.
All right, well, thanks both. As for the podcast, we'll be back in a couple of weeks with our Halloween film. We'll be talking about the 1931 Dracula, so I'm really looking forward to that. That's all for today, though. So I hope you can join me next time, listeners, when the curtain rises once again at the Movie Palace.
If you enjoyed this episode of the Movie Palace and you'd like to support the podcast financially, you can buy me a cup of coffee via the Ko-fi website. Go to ko-fi.com/Carl Sweeney. That's ko-fi.com/Carl Sweeney. C-A-R-L-S-W-E-N-E-Y. Thank you.